Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Since when did North Texas become an earthquake zone? For much of the region's recorded history, seismic activity strong enough to be felt by people on the surface was almost unheard of. But since 2008, geologists have confirmed well over 100 quakes in places like Azle, Cleburne, and Irving, whose residents are still talking about a swarm of mild quakes last week, apparently centered near the site of the old Texas Stadium. Many people suspect there must be some link between all the movement underground and the regional surge in hydraulic fracturing activity. But as we'll discuss this hour, simply identifying the shape and size of regional faults, let alone proving what might have triggered them to move, will require a great deal of ongoing study. My guests today join us from the Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences at SMU. Both are involved in a research project to pinpoint the exact location of recent earthquakes and to map the fault involved. Brian Stump is Albritton Professor of Earth Sciences. Heather Deshaun is Assistant Professor of Geophysics. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start at the beginning. What is an earthquake exactly?
Well, in these cases, it's a fault at depth, and it's a place where there is stress. And when that stress is relieved, the earth moves slightly, and it generates what we call P and S waves that travel away, and you can feel those that ground motion.
And how deep down do they originate?
So the earthquakes that have happened in North Texas tend to occur between 3 and 10 kilometers depth, so 5 or 6 miles.
Mm-hmm. And does the depth of where they originate have anything to do with how widely they are felt throughout the region?
Well, if they're shallower, they have a shorter path to propagate to the surface, mm-hmm. and so the waves haven't attenuated or haven't decreased in amplitude as much. So the same size earthquake can be felt a little more if they're more shallow.
All right. Is there a threshold to be met in terms of how powerful that fault movement is before it's actually called an earthquake? Is there some other term for the mildest of these events?
It's an open scale, mm-hmm. and so that there can be many, many earthquakes that you and I don't feel. They could be magnitude 2s and 1s and 0s. Magnitude is sometimes a confusing term, but you can think of each magnitude unit is a factor of 10. About magnitude 2 to 2.3 is the threshold for felt reports. So there are many, many earthquakes that occur that none of us feel.
So a magnitude 4 is 10 times more powerful than a magnitude 3?
Yes, and it's actually 30 times more energy.
And all the quakes in this area so far have been relatively mild. Is that accurate? Or how does that from your perspective?
That's correct. So all of the events would be considered small, less than magnitude 4. The largest events occurred in late 2013 out near Mineral Wells, and they were two magnitude 3.7 earthquakes.
Does that suggest that what we might have in the future will continue to be mild? Are there any guarantees?
That's a really good question, and it's a difficult one to answer. But in all of the sequences we've had in the region, as Heather said, mid to upper threes have been the largest, and then the events have decayed away. That being said, looking to the future, that's one thing we don't do well is predicting larger events. And so that is an open question.
Please forgive my naivete. I had sort of assumed that all the faults that are around in the world are things that we knew about, that we had mapped out. But in fact, it turns out to be really challenging in some cases to know exactly what these things look like, where they are, what their structure is. Can you talk a little bit about what that process requires?
So I think we're all most familiar with active plate boundaries, such as California. And so that's where this idea that we know where faults exist comes from. Even out in California, however, they have had significant earthquakes on faults that don't reach the surface. So if you think about a geologist going out and mapping faults based on what they see on the surface, some can be missed. In a setting like North Texas, the faults that we are concerned about are actually millions of years old, and they don't come anywhere near the surface. And so we need to have a lot of information about the subsurface that comes from seismic imaging and large, generally expensive studies that have not been done for like peer-reviewed publications. So there's actually a lot of unknowns about faulting in this area.
Did this shift, I don't know how long both of you have lived in this area, but it did it take you by surprise, starting in 2008, that there were a number of earthquakes in North Texas? Was this something you didn't expect working at SMU?
I can remember Halloween night in 2008, which was the first of the events out near the airport. And I teach an introductory class, Earthquakes and Volcanoes, with Heather. And I remember going into the class that Friday morning to talk about that event and never supposing that that would be a topic in a geology class at SMU, followed that with the deployment of instruments to begin to refine the locations of those earthquakes.
Tell us a little bit about those instruments. First of all, are these things you can like buy off the shelf, or do you have to construct them in a lab somewhere, or do you trick them out to make them exactly what you want?
So the instruments we use are manufactured by other companies. We do not personally own a large set of instruments at SMU, and so there are various ways we procure the instruments. So some of the instruments we have out right now are borrowed from the United States Geological Survey. Some of the instruments are borrowed from it's called the Incorporated Research Institutions for Seismology. It's meant to be a pool of instruments that can be accessed by academic seismologists all across the United States for these sorts of studies.
And what form do they take? Are they like tabletop units? Are they things that get drilled down into the ground? What do they look like?
Well, they come in all flavors and all sizes. The more expensive instruments could be deployed by drilling deep underground to put them in place, and that would be for characterizing very, very small events. In our cases, they all sit on the surface, and they can the instruments themselves can be as big as about 6 by 6 inches to maybe twice that size sit on the surface, and then they're connected to a small computer that records the data, and then hopefully it's connected to a Wi-Fi or a cell phone so the data can come in real time.
How is it that they're able to tell the difference between a true geologic movement and like a large truck passing by and kind of rumbling the building?
An earthquake will look very different. So when the earth moves and you have failure along a fault, you generate P waves and S waves, as Brian mentioned earlier. Those come in on different what we call components of the sensor. So essentially, we measure how the earth moves up, down. Generally, we try to measure north, south, and east, west. And so an earthquake is going to look very distinctive from a surface anomaly like a truck moving by. They'll have a different frequency content. And
so if you know what you're looking for,
if you know what you're looking for, you're not going to be confused.
Okay, so a lot of people say, all right, we didn't used to have fracking and we didn't used to have earthquakes. Therefore, correlation is causation. My understanding is that you guys have not said that's impossible, that there's correlation and causation, but you're not ready to make that leap yet. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, I think that as we were talking about measuring the P waves and S waves, the further you're away from the earthquake, the greater the time difference between those, and you use that to locate the earthquakes. Right now, the earthquakes have been located by the United States Geological Survey with stations that are hundreds to thousands of kilometers away. And so there are errors in their estimates. And so before you can talk about the cause of the events, you need to deploy local instruments so you can get very precise locations. And so before we have the precise locations, we're real reluctant to talk about or even begin to address the questions associated with the cause.
I am going to ask you some general questions as we move through
sure.
the hour, but I won't ask you to diagnose anything for us.
All right.
The term epicenter is what people hear in the news and that sort of thing. Is that the term used by experts? And how large is the area that is considered the center of an earthquake?
So the epicenter refers to the surface projection mm-hmm. of the earthquake. So if we were going to talk about latitude and longitude and depth, a seismologist would use the term hypocenter instead. And an earthquake location like those we calculate and those the USGS calculates actually identify where the rupture starts. in an event. So the larger the event, the further the rupture propagates away. So if we look at the 2004 Sumatra earthquake, for example, that was a magnitude 9.2 earthquake. So very different scale than what we're having in Texas, obviously. The rupture area on that was nearly 1,300 kilometers. So we are much, much, much smaller than that here with the magnitude twos and threes. And so we're really talking about rupture lengths of less than a kilometer, maybe.
How precise can you get with identifying the hypocenter if you have your equipment in place?
If you have good station distribution around the earthquake and at a range of distances for the earthquake, we can go below a kilometer to the hundreds of meters.
And knowing exactly where they originate tells you what about what might be causing them?
Well, it essentially helps you image the fault. Mm-hmm. And so you begin to image the fault. The number of events are going to occur along that fault, so you get an idea of the total length of the fault. And that helps you in thinking about what the maximum size of an event that might occur.
Is there reason to believe at this point that the same fault is responsible for what's been happening in Cleburne as Azle as Irving?
Well, I think that the faults in the area, the sequence of faults in the Fort Worth Basin and the surrounding, they're all related to these events. The events in Irving are probably on a different small component of fault than those that occurred at the DFW airport or at Azle or in Cleburne.
So when you have these events happening, sometimes it seems that they're pretty isolated and sometimes they've been happening in what has been called a swarm. Can we assume that swarms are related to one another, directly related to one another? Like, does one little earthquake beget another?
So, yes, the likelihood of another earthquake occurring when an earthquake just occurred does increase. Now, you know, something like a 3.6, like we have in Irving, is going to generate aftershocks, right? So people are more familiar with the main shock and then the aftershocks. So every earthquake essentially generates its own aftershocks, except usually at a smaller magnitude. So the difference with a swarm is that the largest event doesn't necessarily occur first.
Hmm. So what is an aftershock exactly? That's just a further settling of whatever exists along the fault?
Yeah, because you've had a displacement on the fault, and the aftershocks are going to follow as the fault kind of comes back into equilibrium. And so typically when we have a large earthquake, the aftershocks will fill the entire fault surface that that slipped in the original event.
People know a lot about their foundations in this part of the country and worry a lot about their foundations. Are the kinds of earthquakes we've had, at the magnitudes we've had at this point, do they appear to be a risk to property and buildings?
You know, I'm not an engineer, and so I can't. But as a seismologist, I would say that these are small earthquakes. I'm not going to say there hasn't been, you know, some modest damage possibly. But in general, I would expect that the earthquakes would have to be maybe a magnitude unit or more bigger to cause substantial damage.
We're speaking this hour with Brian Stump, who is Albritton Professor of Earth Sciences at SMU, and Heather Deshaun, Assistant Professor of Geophysics at SMU, about earthquakes in North Texas. If you've had questions about this, now is the time to get them answered. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about recent North Texas earthquakes with two professors from SMU. Heather Deshaun is Associate Professor of Geophysics. Brian Stump is Allbritton Professor of Earth Sciences. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So this month, the Bulletin of the Seismological Society of America published this study linking 77 earthquakes in Ohio to hydraulic fracturing activity there. Lots of people assume fracking must be to blame here, and this is what we were talking about before. Can you talk about, just in a little bit more depth, what would be required to prove or disprove a link between any kind of human activity or any kind of natural activity and what's happening right now?
Well, I think many studies start off with a kind of a correlation in space and time with a sequence of earthquakes and a human activity. We ourselves have published two papers in that theme of things. But important is to follow that up with an understanding of the processes that go on. And so let's say that if it was the injection of fluids, how fluids might move underground, how they might interact with faults, and how they might trigger them. That's a much more stringent kind of a study, and one that I think is needed in some sense to try to understand these kinds of events.
When you mention the fluids, there are two different things here that people talk about when they think about possibly human-caused earthquakes and fracking. There is the actual fracking of these, the creation of these wells that will release natural gas, and fluid is put down into them and then pumped back out again. And then there is the spent fluid that is right now commonly disposed of in these things called injection wells. Am I correct that in other places, injection wells, earthquake activity is more likely to be correlated with injection wells than with the actual fracking sites?
Well, yes. And in fact, you go back to the early 60s. A number of fundamental studies were done at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal in Colorado, where they were disposing of wastewater fluids from other kinds of processes. And in that case, they were able to dispose of the fluids, and the earthquakes increased. They stopped. The earthquakes decreased. And since that time period, there have been a number of studies that have made the link between the disposal of fluids, whether it's with oil and gas or geothermal or a wide variety of kinds of things. The other process you talk about is hydrofracking, where they do use fluids to break underground materials. It's much smaller amount of fluids, so they're not as they don't penetrate as far. But as you mentioned, in October there was a study that was published in the BSSA, and I think there have been now maybe about six studies around the world where these kinds of linkages have been made. I would add, though, even in the case of disposal of fluids, there are many disposal of fluid wells that have no earthquakes associated with them.
And fluids are disposed of for any number of purposes, as you said, beyond hydraulic fracturing.
That's right. And for instance, carbon sequestration. There's one process that people have talked about is liquefying carbon dioxide and disposing of it underground.
So how far down do disposal wells typically go? Can you generalize an answer like that?
I'm not going to provide a generalized answer. I'm going to provide an answer for what's going on in the Fort Worth Basin.
Perfect.
So they hydrofrack and extract gas out of the Barnett Shale. And then underneath the Barnett Shale is this very thick limestone unit called the Ellenberger. And that's the injection unit in this area. So that lies at approximately 2 to 3 kilometers depth. It's about a kilometer thick, so it's a significant unit throughout the region.
Is there any reason if it were determined that the fracking process itself, we'll set aside injection wells for just a moment, if the fracking process itself were sort of determined to be a significant risk factor, would the risk go away once the initial fracking is over and when the well is simply operational? Is there reason to believe that's true?
I think those kinds of questions are exactly why you want to have a physical model to try to understand these things. I will say that when they frack, they do generate very, very small earthquakes or very small fractures that are like magnitude ones or zeros along the way. And they're able to watch those earthquakes move, and then they decay away after the fracture process.
So is I want to make sure I'm understanding this. You're saying they create fractures. They're not creating little faults, right?
No. They're okay. Breaking the rocks themselves, and that increases the porosity and permeability of the rock to recover the fluids.
How long has fluid injection technology been used?
Are you
How long have we been digging very deep holes in the ground to get rid of liquids that we don't want to have on the surface?
I guess I should know that, but certainly it's gone on for 50 or 60 years.
Okay, so it's not a brand new technology.
It's
not a brand new technology.
We have an email here to think@kera.org from Texas Mailman. Texas Mailman wants to know, are the earthquakes in any way related to the Balcones escarpment?
So I'm going to assume with that question they're referring to the Irving earthquakes in particular. We are not able at this time to say what fault the earthquakes that are occurring in Irving are occurring on. And so there we also can't say which fault system. So I would not speculate that they were happening on the Balcones proper at this time.
And to put it in perspective, the USGS locations have an area of 2 to 5 miles, something like that, maybe on the lower end. And that's not quite good enough to associate it with a particular fault yet. And that's why we've deployed the local instruments, is, as Heather said, to reduce that to maybe as good as 100 meters.
Is there any good way to predict that an earthquake is imminent?
Not really.
Yeah, I like the term sometimes forecasting, mm-hmm. in that particularly along plate boundaries where we know we're storing strain and we know at what rate we're storing strain, it allows us to understand that over a time period that we might expect an earthquake. But often when we do that, we talk about time periods of tens of years because we have recurrence rates of several hundred years for the earthquakes. In a region like ours here where we don't have much history of past events, that's a much more difficult question to answer. We would like to understand how long these faults are and how big they are that are moving at this point in time to begin to think about some of those kinds of questions.
How far back does historic data go with regard to earthquakes in this part of the world, given that maybe people weren't using, you know, equipment? There might have been a lot of earthquakes that happened that just nobody felt.
So for this part of the world, we rely on felt reports, and usually those would appear in newspaper articles and things like that. So both the recorded history and the human history are very short, 100 to 150 years relative to geologic time. And that is something that we always have to keep in mind.
And when we look at the felt reports or the things that have appeared in newspapers over the last 100 years, within the Fort Worth Basin, there's one possible felt report in 1950.
So does this feel like an anomaly to you, what's happened since 2008? Is it notable? How notable is it that suddenly we are experiencing a lot of earthquakes?
Well, I would say in my lifetime it's notable, mm-hmm. and I imagine for many of the listeners it's notable. Whether or not, though, there have been other sequences like this 150 years ago or 250 years ago, we don't know because we haven't had a populated area here. And that's one of the things that we as geologists deal with, is that human timeframes and geologic timeframes are vastly different. And so that's why we want to record these and try to study them and understand them in some way.
What is most puzzling to you about what we've seen recently, and what are the questions that you're most interested in answering?
I guess one of the things is where we started cause and effect. Mm-hmm. That if we can characterize the events and then after we locate and understand the seismicity, try to take that next step into exploring the causes. But unfortunately, and it's frustrating for people, that's not a short-term kind of a solution. And typically that can take a year, that can take several years to try to address some of those kinds of issues.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Chris. I had a question. You know, I was thinking about the earthquakes in Irving and really comparing them more to, say, the faults in Missouri in the 1800s around New Madrid and places like that. And just was wondering, is it necessary, are earthquakes always associated with some sort of fault, or can they happen in Missouri in places that are not necessarily otherwise associated with fault systems or known disruptions in the Earth's crust?
So when you have an earthquake, you have a fault. Now, the Missouri situation is a bit different because you're referring to the New Madrid seismic zone. And the New Madrid seismic zone is associated with an old rift system, a reactivated old rift system, and it has a long, we would call it paleo-seismology history of having large earthquakes. So I don't consider New Madrid and North Texas to really be comparable because New Madrid is a known intraplate fault system with a long history of generating large earthquakes.
When you go back in history, and it's got to be frustrating. On the one hand, you deal, as you both mentioned, with huge swaths of geologic time. On the other hand, some of the very large earthquakes that we know of in history, what you have is people's memories. You have art. You have newspaper accounts when they exist. What kinds of clues are left behind that can tell you about past earthquake activity?
Heather mentioned paleoseismology. Mm-hmm. And so if you know there is a fault, you can actually trench across the faults and look for disruptions of layers, and particularly if the earthquakes involve vertical motion. You can look for something called sand blows, which are associated with liquefaction, where the shallow layers become liquefied and they can flow onto the surface. You could look for trees and things that might have died at that time and do dating of those trees. So there are a number of tools that you can use to kind of extend back from, 100 to 200 years to 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years.
But those probably work better with large events than with more minor ones.
And larger faults that regularly generate earthquakes, like the San Andreas or the subduction zone off the coast of the state of Washington.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Paul in North Branch says, can seismic activity lead to subsurface fractures that allow liquid from one location, for example, a petroleum concentration or contaminated water injection well, to flow to another depth where there is a potable water aquifer used for human consumption or agriculture?
That's a difficult question to answer without knowing the details of the rocks and the materials that are at depth. And in addition, distances and depths that might separate, for instance, a gas field from the drinking water. In our case, in Texas, the drinking water is relatively shallow and a long ways from where the oil and gas is being recovered. So I would think probably not.
So it could happen among naturally occurring, like aquifers and gas fields, and it could also occur theoretically across man-made water sources.
It's possible.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. Jim is on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Oh, yes, thanks. I've had a question in my mind about the how long does it take to develop a fault, or have they existed since the original land mass was developed, or have they developed over time?
Thanks for your call.
That's a good question. I mean, it's going to depend on the fault size. I think the thing to remember about the faults here is that for the most part, they are millions of years old. And so they don't come to the surface because they have not been active for thousands of years, right? There's no evidence that they've displaced relatively younger rock units or sediments. So an active plate boundary fault in that fault system is constantly developing, but a fault, you know, faults can take thousands of years to reach the size, or millions of years to reach the size that we would see now. And so,
yeah, I might add, an interesting question, even though these are old and maybe classified as inactive faults, a question is how do faults die? And I think it's as we study more about faults, even though they're not active today, they still have stresses, and they may be stressed very close to their breaking point. And so small changes in that stress regime may trigger these small to moderate earthquakes, and in some sense explain seismicity in the stable part of the continent in the United States.
So in other words, is there a great deal of transfer of energy from the activity of one fault to one that is sort of isolated?
Well, we're in the middle of the continent, so the plate boundary doesn't have a big contribution. But there are regional stresses, even in the central part of the continent, because of those. And sometimes when those regional stresses then align in a positive way with old faults, we can have earthquakes within the continent.
Brian Stump is here. He's Albritton Professor of Earth Sciences at SMU. Heather Deshawn is here as well. She is Associate Professor of Geophysics at SMU. We're talking about earthquakes in North Texas. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour from two scientists from SMU. Heather Deshawn is Associate Professor of Geophysics. Brian Stump is Albritton Professor of Earth Sciences. We're talking about earthquakes in North Texas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So the petroleum industry employs a lot of geologists for a lot of different purposes. Are they willingly sharing with academic experts information about what they know about faults in this part of the country?
I would say that they're interested, and there's been good conversations. I think that that's one reason that we want to locate these earthquakes very precisely, because that provides a starting point for that conversation. As Heather said, understanding what the subsurface looks like in three dimensions is important to interpret the seismic data. And in a region where there's oil and gas, they build such three-dimensional models. And so I think ultimately the solution of these kinds of problems is a collaborative one that involves many, many different kinds of people, and they're some of the people that will be important in these studies.
If at this stage we cannot definitively link fracking activity with North Texas earthquakes, is it also true that we can't definitively say there is no relationship?
I'd say yes. It is important to point out that the previous published studies in this area have linked earthquake activity to wastewater injection. Mm-hmm. So within the Fort Worth Basin,
That's sort of step two in the fracking process.
Yes, if you want to think of it that way. So just as it's hard to say yes, oil and gas activity has caused the earthquakes, it's hard also to prove an earthquake is natural.
Yeah, and I think and we've published some of those papers making those linkages in a couple cases and use words like possible and plausible. But I'll go back to where we started our conversation in that a physical understanding of the mechanisms and processes underground, the faults themselves and their strengths, as well as an understanding of fluids and how they move and how they might change stress regimes underground is what needs to be done in order to really address these kinds of problems.
So when you talk about fluids moving underground, I mean, is it possible that, that injecting fluid just lubricates a fault and makes it really easy for that fault to slip?
Yeah, the fluids could move, and then when they interact with the faults, change the stress regime, which is kind of what you're saying.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Bradford in Irving. Hey, Bradford.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
My question is, as a region that's been in a drought for a very, very long time, could the addition of the rain that we've had throughout the past, I don't know, couple of weeks, added any stressors to the fault lines in order to cause such an earthquake?
So we do consider water level changes that would be associated with drought. I mean, keeping in mind that water is very heavy, and something like impounding a reservoir has historically been known to cause earthquakes, not here in Texas, but in other parts of the country. So whenever we embark on studies of cause, we look around, you know, if there's major lakes that have lost water or gained significant water, we can do stress calculations about how stress has changed on faults at depth, as long as we know where the faults are. So again, first we have to identify the fault locations. We also look at significant water level changes. Now, rain events alone are probably not enough. Even when we look at something like changing a lake by 7 feet, we found that the stress changes at a fault at depth are actually very, very small. But we do consider issues related to the ongoing drought.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Don who asks, do you know what magnitude earthquake Dallas's elevated highways are engineered to withstand? The new elevated HOV lanes south of 635 along I-35 are located within about a mile of what appears to be the epicenter.
I do not. I would assume that the engineers that designed those buildings know very well what the answer to that question is.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Carlos is on the line in Dallas. Hey, Carlos.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm enjoying the show. My question is, we're basically removing a pressurized gas from underground, and we're putting in fluids, and we're putting in sand. Now, from my experience and being around the world, I see that the land is literally dying every time we remove this gas. Okay, I don't know what effects it poses on the actual natural wildlife. But my concern and my fear is that we're basically brittleizing the ground and it's going to fall out from underneath us. I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
I'm hoping you're going to say that's not going to happen.
I don't believe that will happen. You know, the depths and the locations of the earthquakes we're looking at are quite far removed from the free surface. And so I don't believe that that is in effect. I don't know. Heather may have.
No, I would agree with Brian on this question.
Where does the money come from for the kind of work that you're doing and that other geologists and seismologists are doing to understand the nature of events like the ones we've experienced in North Texas?
So all of the studies conducted by SMU within the last few years have been funded through Southern Methodist University. We have funding through the University Research Council. So in other words, the Southern Methodist University faculty have decided that this is something important that needs to be studied. the U.S. Geological Survey makes money available to study potentially induced seismicity issues. The National Science Foundation has funded some studies on potentially induced seismicity. Again, not any of we don't have any money from the USGS or NSF at this point in time, but they have. Some states run seismic networks, which have grown as the number of earthquakes have increased in their states. I'm thinking here of Oklahoma and Arkansas in particular. So sometimes there's state money in addition to federal money. And the industry is very interested in mitigation and understanding these potential links between their exploration activity and earthquakes. And so sometimes industry money can go into these studies as well.
So I think, as Heather noted, that there are a lot of interested parties in these kinds of things. And it's always my hope that it is in a collaborative kind of studies. And in some sense we have. As she noted earlier, the USGS has loaned us instruments, and we provided telemetry to them to look at the data. The National Science Foundation, these instruments that we've borrowed are ultimately supported by the National Science Foundation.
Given what we know about, and I love this phrase, potentially induced seismicity, which I guess is man-made earthquakes. Am I correct about that?
Mm-hmm.
Are regions of the country, of the world, that have known really significant faults that could cause major damage if they were to be activated in some way, are those places simply not allowing the kinds of petroleum exploration that we have here?
I don't know if I can answer that question in particular, but I would say that some of the same techniques we use here are used in California.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the reservoirs are stimulated in the same ways.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Joshua on the line in Arlington. Hi, Joshua.
Good afternoon. I'm curious about the relationship between the Texas Railroad Commission and geology. I guess my question for the panelists would be, how does the Railroad Commission gather geological information, if they do at all, and then what is the relationship or what effect does the Railroad Commission have on professional geology? Thanks.
Thanks so much for your call. And for people who don't know, by the way, the Texas Railroad Commission is like the worst name ever for the state agency that regulates a number of things, including the oil and gas industries and their operations in Texas.
Maybe I'll start out and then let Heather add back in. But the Texas Railroad Commission, I believe, has a responsibility for permitting of wells. And also, as a result, there are databases that go with those wells. For instance, the disposal of fluids, the volumes and pressures as a function of time each month. And that's publicly available kinds of data. Those are kinds of data that are useful in these studies.
And I would just add that since the AZEL sequence began in 2013, the Texas Railroad Commission has hired a seismologist. We at SMU, we keep in close contact with that seismologist. And the Railroad Commission, in addition to the data that they collect regularly, can request additional information such as daily volumes and pressures from nearby wells when earthquakes occur. And the new seismologist in the Railroad Commission has been very good in responding to additional data requests.
Heather, you mentioned before the show that you've experienced a couple of these at your home. Brian, have you felt them as well?
Slightly embarrassing, but I have not felt one of these.
Are you envious of that? Do you wish
of this? I went to school and grew up in California, so I've experienced plenty of earthquakes in my life. But unfortunately, I've been moving around when each of these earthquakes have occurred.
What does an expert in the earth sciences notice during the experience of an earthquake that maybe the lay population does not?
Well, I actually also used to live in California, and there I think the largest event I felt was a magnitude 5. And you could actually feel the P wave come in separated from the S wave. So you could actually play the game in your head, oh, that was the P wave and that was the S wave. That event must be so many kilometers away from me. Now, my experiences with these smaller magnitude events in North Texas are a little bit different. If I'm at my house, I joke that based on how loudly the earthquake affects the rafters of my attic, I can get an estimated magnitude. But maybe that's the only it's the only thing. It is the case both out in Azle and with these Irving earthquakes that for people that are, you know, a few miles away, they actually report hearing the events more than they report feeling shaking. And I think that has a lot to do with our houses being on slabs and just how our buildings are built around here.
So what we're hearing is not the earth moving beneath us, but we're hearing our house interacting or whatever building we're in interacting with the moving earth.
That's correct.
Okay. It has to be, on the one hand, frustrating that you are explaining things that maybe your freshman students ought to know when you teach undergrads. On the other hand, I wonder if this is a kind of exciting for you that people are taking a greater than average interest right now in the fields that you study.
I think it's an opportunity. I mean, you know, we live in a dynamic earth and the earth's changing and we forget about that sometimes. And I think we get reminded of that when earthquakes occur. And in that sense, it's an opportunity in some sense to communicate about the earth, ask questions about, you know, how old are faults and how much do they move. And it kind of opens up our eyes a little bit about the world around us.
How much can we learn in North Texas from what's happened in places like Oklahoma and Ohio and elsewhere that appear to be related to human activities?
I think quite a lot. And I think that we have a colleague who has talked about that making a linkage between possible induced events and practices maybe kind of like trying to associate a particular cancer with it, with like smoking, for instance. It's going to be a difficult issue, but I think by looking at instances in a wide variety of areas, we can try to understand the processes, and if we can actually understand what's going on subsurface, think about mitigation. You know, for instance, the pressures that we inject at, the depths that we inject at, where we might want to and not, if the linkage is made.
We might be able to tweak the formula, is what
yes.
you're saying. Brian Stump is All Britain Professor of Earth Sciences at SMU. Heather Deshaun is Associate Professor of Geophysics at SMU. It's been a really informative hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you for inviting us.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.